Okay, well, I hope most of you won't be too bored, since this is basically totally trivial as far as certainly the numerical experts are concerned. But this is just an attempt to apply hyperbolic systems to a very simple problem to get some insight into some of the problems that might exist in a very simple situation, which is just nonlinear plane waves. And this is work done with a student of mine, Louisa Buckman. Okay, so the spatial metric then is just so just a simple, diagonal spatial metric. 1D, so it's just everything just depends on X and T. There's the lapse alpha shift beta, which by the symmetry is in the X direction. And I'm just going to consider two of the well-known metric hyperbolic systems, the Bonamassa system and the Anderson-Dworkin system, though I've modified them to some extent. As I saw fit. Now, one key thing about my approach is, as was emphasized by Anderson and York, is that rather than using a wave equation for the lapse, as in the original Bonamassa paper, I'm going to take an algebraic description for the lapse in terms of a specified function q times the square root of the determinant of the spatial metric. And this, considerably simplifies the hyperbolic system. But then you have the freedom to reset this specified function as you wish after every time step or pardon? Oh, well, the paper I was referring to had them see others. I'm sure you were part of it. But yeah. Oh yeah, this is right, no, this is no, that's fine. No, I agree.
That's the ultimate achievement in type. Now this doesn't small crowd.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, but the idea is that Q can be reset as you wish after every time step, or after every several time steps, depending what you want to do. So write down the familiar 3+1 Vacuum-Einstein equations, the standard form. Constraints, and then during a time step, the lapse evolution basically boils down to just solving this advection equation for Q, since we assume Q is constant along the normals to the hypersurface, not constant at a given spatial location for non-zero shifts. All right, so, and, well, in the Bonamassa notation, you have these DKIJ variables, where this is just 1/2 the derivative of this spatial metric with respect to K, the IJ component, and you can raise and lower indices using the metric. And so you have basically these first derivative variables. Now, Bonamassa actually lowered this index for to get the variables they actually used. So it was 1/2 the derivative of either the 2 lambda rather than lambda prime. Now I'll come back to that. Well, yeah, I mean it makes it simpler because in general, if you don't have a diagonal metric, obviously, I mean if these quantities you are not symmetric in I and J, well the lowered ones are. All right, and you have a derivative of Q, you have to also with this kind of problems being evolved by this kind of equation. and I'm just considering possibly non-zero shift, but shift which is independent of x for simplicity. All right, so so now when we specialize to this plane wave metric, then we just get evolution of the x component of the extrinsic curvature along the normal, and you have the second derivative of the lapse, and then from and these terms together are from the Ricci tensor, and then you have the extrinsic curvature terms, and and then similarly for the y, y, and z, z components. Now,
when you say a plane wave, do you just mean that all the variables are going to depend on one?
Yeah, basically. And for most of what I'm also, well, I'm going to talk about today, are problems where you actually have just waves going in one direction rather than colliding plane waves. Yeah, so it's about prime for time.
Next to
x, right? And then you have the strain equations. So, these are relatively simple equations, which one can hope to see what's going on. And so the hyperbolic system basically consists of, or the what you want to try to put into a hyperbolic form consists of, these evolution equations for the lapse, and then you have evolution equations for the first derivatives of the spatial metric, which from the definition of the extrinsic curvature can be written in terms of evolution of the first derivatives related to the derivative, spatial derivative of the of the extrinsic curvature. So now the, of course, as it's well known, this systems as they stand are not in hyperbolic form, because, well, these two equations for y and z, the transverse components, and these equations combine to give nice wave equations for the transverse part of the metric, basically. But the longitudinal, there's no lambda prime here. No. Well, yeah, the derivatives. I'm not really paying attention to that. In other words, of course, there are derivative beta terms in general, of course. So I'm not worried about that. So okay. Now when you express the lapse in terms of the Yorkshire K, et cetera, Q, then you do get a lambda prime, and because then the evolution for KXX does have this lambda prime with the right sign to give a wave equation. But this is still not a satisfactory hyperbolic form, because it turns out that when you try to look at, if you try to put it in this form of Q dot, where Q is some vector of unknowns time, plus a flux, a function of the Qs, which is basically a matrix. It's a set of n functions if n is the number of variables. Prime is some source. The Jacobian, the partials of the S with respect to Q, the Q should be a matrix which has a complete set of eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and that's not the case, so as things stand, and this is all, of course, very well known. And so the two ways of patching this up, if the Bonamassa approach is to, use the as variables the DKIJs, which are just first derivatives of the spatial metric, KIJs, and of course, the metric variables themselves have evolution equations in terms of exponential curvature, but those are basically trivial because they're just, you know, adracting along the normals in terms of the propagation. So, so what Bonham asked to do is they introduce three redundant variables, in general, three redundant variables, this vector VI, which is a certain combination of the first derivatives of the spatial metric. And in the plane wave case, this reduces to just one non-zero component, which is just mu prime plus nu prime. And then you evolve these auxiliary variables independently, and they basically just adduct along the normals. You have a source term, which is second order, involving, you know, products of spatial derivatives and the exponential curvature. Now, what this does for you is that you well, then you write the flux for the kxx in terms of this v sub x. So you have the q prime, which is the vex along the normal, and then you have the lambda prime, which goes together with the kxx to give a wave equation, and then you have the v sub x, which just propagates along the normal. And this does have then a complete set of eigenvectors and is well behaved in terms of the hyperbolic system. Now, Anderson and York do something which is similar but not exactly the same. And instead of using the raw first derivatives of the metric, they take this combination, which basically amounts to, you know, in terms of in a general case, these are what appear in the fluxes, you know, for the extrinsic curvature, these combinations of the first derivatives of the metric. And this is, in terms of the Bonamassa V, this is just the DKIJ and then plus these two terms involving V. Now, I sort of like to work with the, by raising an index, and that is the longitudinal F, which is lambda prime plus 2 times mu prime plus nu prime, and then the same variables as before for the y, y, and z, components. And now what you do then is you use the momentum constraint to write the evolution equation for F. You know, Bonamassa, you have for the dxxx, which is just lambda prime, you get the evolution equation just from the consistency condition, you know, in terms of the derivative of the extrinsic curvature. In the here now, what we do is we use the momentum constraint to basically eliminate the time derivatives of the mu prime plus nu prime in terms of which you can interchange the order and get u dot are basically, you know, related to the extrinsic curvature, and then the derivative of the extrinsic curvature is for these combination of components is something that is determined by the momentum constraint in terms of second order quantities. So in terms of the principal parts of the hyperbolic system, you've got then this, which now gives you without introducing any extra variables, gives you a nice, you know, hyperbolic system, because now you have F dot being basically the derivative of KXX, and KXX dot being the derivative of the FXXX.
So far I've understood the ruling of plane wave, and you work down the equation one.
Well, the only I'm not claiming,
or this is just a
Well, I'll talk about, you know, what seems to be better in this, for this particular problem anyway.
Right.
I mean, I make no claims about some general statement about what's better. Yeah. But, all right, so in a sense, then the Asin-Yor scheme is more economical and it doesn't introduce any extra variables. But it does mean that now in the Bonamasso, where the dxx dot, well, it's beta dxx prime, you just have, it's just, you have this flux term from kxx, and you have no source terms, but now you do have source terms here. Who's? Well, I'm going to show you results from both. I mean, I'm comparing them, right. So these are just, you know, the two. And so, all right, so the initial conditions I'm going to take then are just the standard textbook nonlinear plane wave, where if you write the metric in this form, beta represents sort of the physical transverse traceless gravitational wave, and it's some arbitrary function of retarded prime or retarded, you know, position. And then L of u you get from the constraint equations and satisfies the simple second order equations in terms of the beta prime. And now the analytic solution, this analytic solution then has lambda equal kxx equals 0 initially, the Laplace equal to 1, Laplace equal to 1, and then the and beta in terms of nu prime, k, in terms of, you know, these other variables, just given by this, and the log L, similarly. So, of course, now in the hyperbolic system, when we evolve with Q just advecting along the normals, or it's not really fixed exactly, but x along the normals, then this does not preserve these conditions, right? So the Laplace then becomes not equal to 1, and these longitudinal metric and extensive curvature, curvatures do not remain 0. Now, if we look at the equations, so you have go back and look at the equations. You can see that, well, that the here that then what we have is that the evolution of kxx involves this divergence of this. Now lambda prime is initially 0, so you have but q prime over q plus 2 mu prime plus nu prime is not 0. And then you have these nonlinear source terms, which, you know, and so you have basically, you know, something which is non-zero here and non-zero here, trying to determine something which is initially at least very, very small. So it's a somewhat unpleasant numerical situation to be in, which means that, you know, things are quite sensitive to numerical errors. Now the same sort of cancellation, in a sense, well, so this is true in both schemes, that you have this cancellation between the flux of the divergence of the flux for kxx dot and the source terms. Now, in the York, Anderson-York scheme, there's also a second Alfred cancellation in a sense, in that if you want to find lambda prime, you have to get it by subtracting 2 mu prime plus nu prime, which you get, you know, from the wave equations for involving these variables, from this fxx. And again, initially, you know, I mean, these subtract to zero, so your lambda prime is, again, somewhat ill-conditioned. Now, and this, okay, so now you have these basically now three pairs of, really pairs of wave modes, right and left going. You have the physical modes, which you can think of as being, you know, the transverse, traceless part, which have characteristic velocities at light speed and right and left, involving these combinations of the variables. Then you have a transverse gauge mode, which is the symmetric combination of the derivatives and the eccentric curvature, the transverse, you know, metric and eccentric curvature derivatives, and eccentric curvature, again, with just the light speed and characteristic velocities. But now you have then a longitudinal gauge modes, which involving lambda prime and kxx in Bonamassa, or fxxx and kxx in Anderson, New York, which are coupled to the modes which advect along the normals involving q and v sub, in the case of Bonamassa, the v sub x extra variable. And so in terms of this system, you have three characteristic velocities, the minus the shift, and then the two light speeds. Now, you can see from the equations that these two modes, if they are purely right going initially, they remain exactly purely right going, and that's, of course, true for the analytic solution. But the point is, even in sort of, you start out that way, regardless of what happens to lambda prime and kxx, you can see that there's perfect cancellation. There's no backscatter, in other words, of the this plane wave problem for these modes. On the other hand, the longitudinal modes, if you look at the source terms, if you assume, say, initially you have something that's purely right going, then the source terms generate left going waves, you know, and so so you do not maintain a purely right going solution. Now, now the way I, you know, well, it's this is a result of, you know, the point symmetry. I don't particularly have a sound statement about that. But now, so if we give bright going initial conditions, then this, you have this, you know, physical wave which goes to the right, and it generates, now the point is lambda prime and kxx remain zero to the right of the physical wave, because, you know, it's, that's outside the, you know, the domain of dependence of the non-zero data you have initially. And but to the left of the physical wave, you do have a non-zero this transverse gauge mode is non-zero. Also, the lapse remains equal to one. Well, you can impose boundary conditions in the equation on the lapse, and there's nothing that in the evolution with fixed Q, which, you know, where there are no waves, other waves, the lapse stays equal to one. But to the left of the physical wave, where you do have these gauge modes, the lapse does does evolve away from one. All right, so, you know, how do we, I said we want to reset the lapse. How do we do that? Well, there are various ways one might imagine doing it, but what I've done is two simple things. One is, the simplest is just reset the lapse to one after every time step or every couple of time steps. And so, obviously, and for log q and log q prime, you get values. So the point is you have the spatial metric at the end of a time step, and then you just determine q from this and then go on to the next time step without changing that and you renew. Now, the second scheme is to, which I think is probably is more like what one might like to do in a more general circumstance, is resetting alpha by, if we go back to the equation in this form for, say, kxx, you can treat this as an equation for alpha at a given time, where you want to, now we want to set this right-hand side equal to minus gamma times kxx, where gamma is some damping coefficient. And that gives you an equation for alpha, which you can numerically integrate at that given time that you're doing resetting. And so that's the way that works. And what I do is typically is then take the damping constant to be just one over the time step. Well, you know, as a gauge in terms of, you know, well, you could, of course. But it's not, I think, something you want to do in general. I mean, it's been shown by other people that if you do take that gauge, then you can get, you know, coordinate singularities developing as things evolve. Well, again, I'm going to compare the results. Well, I don't know. I mean, the philosophy, well, I mean, I don't think you really want to do this in any general problem because, you know, but this, you know, for instance, say in a 3D problem, you know, asymptotically flat problem, you wanted to have something that was at least approximately maximal hypersurfaces, then you could do the same thing. Instead of kxx, you use trace k and get an equation. Well, so it gives you, you know, it's a way of sort of controlling how the hypersurfaces evolve. Now, you know, what I think you would like to do in general is you know, find, you know, the point is you would like to evolve the hypersurfaces in ways which suitable to the problem. Now, in the case of, say, black hole collisions, you would like to, let's say, you know, you do excision, then you would like to evolve the hypersurfaces so you don't develop large gradients in the lapse and the spatial metric, say near the apparent horizon, and you might also want to evolve it, you know, at large R to maybe approach characteristic surfaces or something. Well, trace K equals zero is not a natural thing for the plane wave because, you know, the symmetries pick out particular directions. And so this is sort of the closest you can get to that.
So there's no way to reset alpha, which means you change the equation effectively, so you're no longer computing the hyperbolic system to start with.
Well, I would argue you aren't really, you're just changing the coordinates as you go along. You're not changing the, so the hyperbolic system basically, you know, it's the same system, but you're just evolving the coordinate system in some some way, which you're trying to keep under control.
If you are, I think, in the speed, you have this condition, you are solving the alpha in state.
Right.
So that looks like you're changing the hyperbolic into a hyperbolic ballistic system.
Well, you know, this was discussed last spring, but, you know, you could conceivably get in trouble doing this if you did it, you know, careful, so in a certain sense, you are changing. Well, I mean, you're obviously changing the equation that you're solving. but in terms of the hyperbolic, you know, you're not changing the hyperbolic system. I would.
I mean, how can I put it?
I'd be
drawn down to the person in the audience. I asked another question.
Okay, now as far as battery conditions, well, the simple thing to do, you know, the standard methods for solving and using hyperbolic systems and battery conditions, typically doing some kind of extrapolation to fill the ghost cells at, you know. Now, I'm not doing any flux limiting in these calculations, so you only need one ghost cell at each, you know, one extra cell outside the grid, your main grid, in order to be able to evolve things. And so you have to say something about, you know, what the values of the variables are in those ghost cells. And so one thing you can do is just extrapolate them using, you know, just saying they're equal to the value of the neighboring physical cell, or you do a linear extrapolation or say a quadratic extrapolation. Now, what I found was that under most circumstances in this problem, these seem to give instabilities associated with the boundary if you just did that. Now, at least in many cases then, what you can do as doing this for most of the variables, but then it's these two combinations are, you do have derivatives, you know, the x derivatives, you know, for the the spatial derivatives of these quantities, or the x derivatives of these quantities in the case of the plane wave, are determined by the constraint equations. So if you use the constraint equations to essentially extrapolate these combinations to the ghost cell, and then everything else, you just use a simple one of these standard extrapolation schemes. Now, and this basically assures that any incoming waves you might have at the boundary are consistent with the constraints. Now, this doesn't solve all problems with boundaries, but it certainly makes things a lot better. At least at the left edge of the grid. I mean, the left of the grid, you have this transverse gauge mode, which is coming in, right, to your domain. These combinations are basically the transverse gauge mode. And so what the constraint equations do is allow you to extrapolate this transverse gauge mode to the ghost cell at the left edge. Now, It turns out if you use this at the right edge, for reasons I don't completely understand, you do tend to get an edge of instability. In that case, extrapolation seemed to work better. So I don't fully understand that. But okay, so now the types of calculations I'm going to show you then are Bonamassa, where I'm using these sort of logarithmic derivative variables, in other words, the mixed kxx, kyy, kzz, mixed components of the extrinsic curvature and the logarithmic derivatives of the metric as the variables, and it's referred to as BM2, because it's not what Bonamassa originally did. Anderson, New York, you can use the logarithmic derivatives, in other words, raise the J index in the FKIJ and the mixed KIJ. And this is something, if you want to do this in general for a non-diagonal metric, this means you have to introduce extra variables because the KIJs are not symmetric when they're mixed components are not symmetric, but you still have, it doesn't really affect the hyperbolic system particularly, you just have more variables with the same kind of hyperbolic system. Now the now 3 and 4 are Bonamassa in the original form for the, what they chose, somewhat simpler because now these are automatically symmetric in I and J. And similarly, Anderson, New York with everything downstairs, which again, symmetric in I and J. All right, so in the now, what I find then is that as long as there are no instabilities, all these schemes are second order. I get results which are second order convergent and extrapolating to zero step size, sequence of step sizes, extrapolating the results, everything agrees within sort of reasonable errors. However, I do find that a given step size that the errors are substantially larger for these two choices of variables as compared to these two. And the main reason is the the sensitivity of longitudinal gauge mode to numerical errors. And when you use these variables, you have to, the thing which really, you have to, transverse gauge mode has to be determined very accurately in order these delicate cancellations in the longitudinal gauge mode work out right. And when you, to get the transverse gauge mode from these variables, you have to divide, take combinations with the metric, and that introduces extra numerical error. Okay. But on the other hand, there's very little difference between these two schemes, one and two, in terms of numerical accuracy. The only differences really are when you get instabilities. Three and four are also very similar in terms of the results. Yeah. Yeah. Absolute errors. I'm judging the errors by the relative errors, basically. I mean, if you have something that's converging, and so, I look at the convergence in terms of the absolute errors, but of course, once you start converging, there's not much difference between absolute and relative for a given quantity.
Okay.
Well, I mean, no, judging the quality of the air is, it's relative. I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, looking at extrapolation, I mean, I do it for absolute errors, but judging, in when I say the errors are bigger, I mean relative errors. In other words, it in other words, when you end up comparing the same, exactly the same quantity, which, you know, then will be a somewhat different combination of your variables in one, you know, one scheme versus the other, you know, compare the same quantity and look at how it converges. That's how I judge the, so it's no, I didn't use their lapse evolution. All right. Okay. Right. Okay. Now, what about instabilities? Well, now one problem I did find with the Anderson-York scheme is that if you started off with these initial conditions, you know, that lambda prime and kxx are zero, then, and just evolve it, you know, where, then if you calculate the derivative of this longitudinal metric function lambda as a numerical derivative of what you get from lambda, which is mainly determined by the evolution of lambda is determined basically by kxx. So this is basically something that comes from kxx. You can get in a situation where, and typically do get in a situation where this derivative, when you compare it with this fxxx minus 2 mu prime plus nu prime, which is also supposed to be lambda prime, that they have opposite signs, and you get an exponential growth with that, maintaining that behavior. Now that, of course, violates the constraint that these two should be equal. And of course, it violates the other constraints. Now the way I cured that was to, at least for the first couple of time steps, reset this fxx variable by saying it's lambda prime calculated from the numerical derivative plus 2 times mu plus nu prime. So now that's not something that really is sort of a violation of the hyperbolic scheme, it seems to me. But at least in the case of zero shift, it turns out that if you do that for the first, say, typically 2 time steps, then you don't need to keep redoing it, and it just, you know, everything goes along okay from there, just as far as, you know, this, and you end up, you have the right sign. Now this, of course, is, you have this, you know, problem is associated with this delta cancellation in the plane wave case. I'm not saying it, claiming that it has any, you know, have really likely, anything like it would be likely to show up in more general or some typical circumstance. but it is sort of an unpleasant thing about the... now, with non-zero shift, it turns out that it looks like you have... It seems that you have to keep resetting lambda prime to avoid drifting away from this resetting fxx from the numerical derivative of lambda periodically, not every time step, but maybe every 20 or 30 time steps to keep things on track. But if you do that, then the numerical results are not, you do maintain stability and at least as far as this is concerned, and the numerical results are very comparable to what you get, say, from Bonamassa or whatever. Okay, now there are also instabilities associated with the boundary, directly with the boundary condition. And this basically has to do with the fact that you do have incoming gauge modes, even though, you know, you say would like, you start with a physical wave, which is inside your grid, and you, as if it, when it runs out the edge, you just want to have outgoing wave boundary conditions. So, but the problem is, you do have these incoming gauge modes, and it's a rather delicate business to get their amplitude right so that you don't get some sort of runaway behavior right at the edge. And, alright, so it's this which the using the constraints to, at least for the transverse gauge mode, seem to help at the left edge. On the other hand, at the right edge, it seems to be better just to use straight extrapolation. Okay, so that's the... Now I'd like to just show you some of the results. Okay, here we have... This is looking at the physical wave, so you're taking the, you know, the transverse extrinsic curvature, transverse traceless extrinsic curvature, and showing t equals 0, t equals 4, t equals 8, and you get a nice pulse propagating to the right. I should say in general that as far as, you know, sort of the mu and nu and k, yy and kzz variables, you get quite good results, accurate results, regardless, you know, for any of these methods, basically, as long as, unless they're affected by instabilities. It's the, you know, longitudinal variables, lambda prime and or kxx, that tend to, you know, you see the differences between the schemes. All right, so so that's very straightforward. These are with a large number of cells, 4,000 cells, so you know, it's getting most accurate results, but again, this is not sensitive to errors. And this is basically the transverse gauge mode. It's, and again, it moves to the right at light speed, and with the constraint extrapolation, you get what seems to be, you know, tracking, but, you know, the incoming gauge mode seems to be set quite well, and everything just goes to the right. Now, the way this is for the resetting lapse to 1, as indicated in the title. So, and then the lapse, log of the lapse, again, is, you know, 0, where the lapse is 1, to the right of the physical wave, and then it. Now, even though we're resetting lapse to 1, this is maybe, you know, not every time step here, every 8 time steps, because in doing convergence tests, you have to reset the lapse at the same time, not at the same number of steps. But but the, so this is at, you know, before resetting the lapse, obviously, after you set it, it's 1. So you get, just before resetting the lapse, you have this result. So you get where the main effect is where the physical wave is, and then some additional effect due to the gauge mode acting to evolve the lap. All right. Oh, where? Well, it's not discontinuous. Well, for this, you know, okay, your gauge condition during, you know, before you reset, I mean, the lapse basically evolves, you know, the time period of the lapse is related to trace K, which is, you know, non-zero. Yeah. So
I guess I'm wondering if I look at the
Well, when you reset, I mean, you're not changing the time when you reset, but there is a definite discount. Yeah, right. I mean, so it's this, and then you're suddenly resetting it to log of the lapse to zero, and you reset it in this case. I mean, now the other method of resetting, where you use it to damp KXX, it actually turns out that the log of the lapse. I'll show you. I don't have a graph of that, but maybe not. But anyway, the lapse actually doesn't get as big in that case, and it's because, you know. Well, as long as you reset at the same time, you know, not the same number of steps, but so like when it, say the step size, you have 4,000 cells, and you have 2,000 cells, you reset every four steps. And so as long as you reset at the same time, you should converge, you know, perfectly well. So because you're solving the same equations between resettings. No, it's first order. Well, it's basically a first order. Well, I mean, it's second order in the physical mode. It's first order in the, say, the transverse gauge mode. But, which, you know, in those, the second order in physical mode is about the same as the first order in the transverse gauge mode. But, you are solving exactly the same equations as long as you reset the lapse at the same time. Yeah. It's purely, you know, it doesn't appear in any of the, at all in any of the evolution. This time derivative doesn't appear in any of the equations, so that's what that you get away with. Okay, so, alright, so if we. And I'll show you the transverse of the longitudinal. Okay, this is KXX, the mixed KXX. And again, resetting lapse to 1. And the solid curve is at, of course, this is 0 at t equals 0, but at solid curve is at t equals 4. And the width of the initial pulse is 4 units. So at t equals 4, the what's propagating at light speed to the right has separated from what's, you know, the original position of the wave, basically. And so what you get is something where you, so t equals 4, you know, what you see is happening is you have, you know, stuff being sort of generated by, you know, the physical wave, which is propagating at light speed to the right. Then you have this, which is, this is with zero shift, so, you know, it's staying fixed, and, you know, and with non-zero shift, this propagates with the shift, right? It advects with the shift, and this you can see that, well, KXX, you know, once things separate like this, then you have this sort of image of the somewhat reduced in amplitude image of the what you get associated with the physical wave, which, you know, at t equals zero, these, you know, this sets on top of that and cancels it, basically. But this is just sitting there at constant x. It's kx, you know, there's sort of a damping. This is, again, with large number of cells, so this, the errors here are sort of probably less than the width of the curve.
Would this feature, or most good.
Yeah, right. And this is...
Right, so then that's just sort of what you might call a danger.
Yeah, so it's you know, the point is resetting lapse to one, sort of, if you didn't reset the lapse, you know, this would sort of keep growing, right? You'd have this part, which is, would just keep growing, but resetting the lapse kills the growth of it, but it doesn't damp it very much. Well, not with this. With this, you know, it all depends on how you reset the lapse, as I'll show you. But now, what that means, of course, if kxx is roughly constant in time, then lambda, the metric function, is growing linearly in time. So it is something that, you know, you don't want to go on forever.
Well, where would the curve to that represent? There's no physical curve?
There's no physical. Right. Well, you do have some... space is actually... It's basically flat space there. I mean, you know from the analytic solution that even though you have... You know, the metric functions are not explicitly flat, that the curvature vanishes everywhere outside where the physical wave is non-zero. So it is just flat space, but, you know, in the, so the curvature is should be zero here. Right, so you have a non-zero curvature in this, this part which travels to the right, but here, this is just purely gauge.
That's pretty typical that you have to do a shift.
Well, but again, it's not something that depends on... The only thing that happens with non-zero shift is that this, say, you know, a shift which gives you the normal coming to the left, something that's propagating normal to the hypersurface has a negative coordinate velocity, then this peak will move to the left. It'll look exactly the same. It won't. The amplitude. Yeah. So as long as as long as the shift is uniform, I should say that, you know, then everything, this whole, you know, what you get is exactly the same curves, just shifted, right? Now with a non-uniform shift, you might be able to do something about that. Okay. Now finally we'll look at the, you know, lambda, and you can see that this linear growth. Actually, lambda tends to be in this sort of left behind. You get a linear growth in lambda because kxx is roughly constant in time. Okay. So all this is done with Bonamassa. Now I'd like to show you, well, first some idea of the accuracy so those calculations were done with what I call basically BM2, 4,000 steps. So this is, you know, very accurate, again, zero shift. Now I'm going to compare the same calculation done with BM1, which is using, so the long dashes, which are these curves, are done using the original Bonamassa variables, but everything else is just a purely, and you can see that for 1,000 steps rather than 4,000 steps, and BM2, this small dashes which is here, is done with the same scheme as this, but with 1,000 steps rather than 4,000 steps. So the heights of these peaks are, there's not too much difference in BM2, but there's a, you know, factor of two difference in BM1. And now what you do get as an error in VM2 is that these troughs are sort of filled in. You know, sort of like there's infective dissipation, which is filling in the troughs. And there's not a whole lot of difference in this gauge stuff over here. So, and this is showing the at least in some cases, I think it is advantageous to use the logarithmic derivatives or the mixed extensive curvature and the mixed DIDs variables. Okay. Now, this is an example, again, comparing 4,000 and 1,000, but with a shift of 1.2. And at the same time, t equal 8. And you may think, well, here, it seems like the accuracy gets better with as the shift increases, but you still have, the same shape for the gauge mode. It's just, the difference between 1,000 steps and 4,000 steps is much smaller in this case. Okay, now here is a comparison between the Bonamassa and the York, at the same time, and for 1,000 cells. And this is York using the logarithmic derivatives variables and the VM2 using logarithmic derivative variables. And you see there's the reason for the shift between the two curves is just different initial starting positions for the pulse. But you can see the shapes are pretty much the same. There's a little bit, these wiggles here are a little sharper in the Bonamassa than they are in New York, but not much difference. The heights of the peaks are essentially identical. Okay, now here the Bonamassa is not having problems, but the York is. This is using the constraint in both cases. In other words, the boundary conditions are the same in both cases. Now I don't understand exactly. So the York does seem to be somewhat more susceptible to these kinds of boundary things. Now this is not, a violent instability. I mean, it hasn't grown to too much by the time t equal 8, which is more probably substantial propagation of things. But it is, much of this, another question is the difference. Well, no, it doesn't really propagate much. It just tends to grow. Of course, with this kind of shift, I mean, everything is going out the left edge, right? So you don't have any waves coming back from the left edge. Now, if you, with a smaller shift, so you did have waves coming back, then it would propagate more out. There would be an effect propagating out at light speed, basically. Okay. Now, this is showing you what happens when you relax the KXX rather than setting alpha to 1. And what I'm comparing here are, and these are the mixed mixed components, KXX, and this is in Bonamassa, and the DXXX. And again, with the mixed components, so this logarithmic derivative. Right. Now, for a wave that's propagating purely to the right, these should be equal. This is also, by the way, this is also normalized to derivative per unit proper distance. So these really should be equal for a purely right going wave, even if non-zero lambda. And which is true, and this is where the physical pulse is, and that's true. Now the KXX solid curve is now essentially very small, everywhere outside the physical pulse, because you're damping, you know, you're damping it. When are you folding every time step, right? I mean, and that's, you know, there's RFX trying to generate it, but it's the sort of equilibrium balance between that and the damping is at a small amplitude. Now, because this, but because you sort of started with even, you know, also the, you know, the amplitudes here are much smaller than they were in the, instead of like, you know, it's at least an order of magnitude smaller than it was when saying alpha equal to 1. So now you do get, still get wiggles in the derivative, but the point is, in the resetting alpha to 1, these would be growing in amplitude, but now the point is, in the, essentially in the, before the first time you reset, you generate some wiggles in the XXX, and then, you know, at this location, basically. And then once you reset, that sort of caps the growth of, because then KXXX goes to zero, starts going to zero. Well, I mean, you do reset KXX initially, you reset the lattice initially, I mean, before you even start the calculation to damp KXX. But the point is, there is some growth, right? Because of this balance, you have, I think, terms generating KXX, and you have this damping that you put in by the choices of the lattice, which are fighting each other. And that produces these wiggles, physical wiggles, which propagate to the right, and leaves you with sort of what you get in between resettings frozen in here. In other words, lambda, there'd be oscillations in lambda, which would be now, instead of growing linearly, are constant in time. So so this is obviously, you know, desirable. More desirable, basically, if you want to do a long, very long time integration. Okay. Well, I'll just conclude then. Let's see. So, say then, you know, because of the sensitivity to of the gauge modes and numerical errors, the nonlinear plane wave is not completely trivial, though it's of course still pretty trivial. The resetting of lattice to actively damp KX stops linear growth in lambda and actually keeps alpha by a factor of 2 or so closer to 1 than resetting lattice to 1. The constraints can be of help, some help in suppressing boundary instabilities, but it doesn't always work in particular, when you start getting a real pulse in the gauge modes hitting the boundary, then things get a little dicier in terms of maintaining boundary stability, even with using the constraints. And using logarithmic derivatives seems to improve numerical accuracy. It has not much effect on stability, but it does affect accuracy. And the Anderson-York scheme, at least for this case, seems to be somewhat more instability prone than Bonamasso, both in terms of this needing to reset lambda prime and in terms of edge effects. And I think, you know, this gives you some insight into why hyperbolic methods are not a magic bullet in terms of, say, boundary conditions, because normally, you know, what you think is, well, it makes it easy to impose outgoing wave boundary conditions, which is true, but the problem is the gauge modes typically will have ingoing components, and getting those ingoing components set in a way which does not cause an instability is not always that easy to do, at least just using some naive scheme. Okay.
Any questions?
So, you know, this, I think you, well, now this, using the constraints to help with the boundary conditions is something one could do in multiple dimensions. I mean, of course, it gets quite a bit more complicated, but boundary conditions in general get quite a bit more complicated in multiple dimensions. Now, whether, you know, how useful it would be, of course, I'm not really sure. And it's probably been tried by some people already. I don't know. Well, in other words, what it is you're setting with the constraints, I mean, the point is, if you look at the constraint equations, you have some derivatives sort of normal to the your boundary, and some derivatives along the boundary. Now, obviously, you can't affect things along the boundary, but the things that you do have normal derivatives of, that combination of whatever it is that you do have, you know, second normal derivatives of, is basically what you can extrapolate here. Well, it's really, well, I mean, in general, well, you have three momentum constraints. Well, so in terms of getting, well, the Hamiltonian constraint is just going to give you one constraint on the spatial derivatives, the first, you know, spatial derivatives when you integrate it, and then the momentum constraint gives you, in general, three conditions. Well, except there's only one component of the momentum constraint that involves derivatives normal to the surface. So again, it's really just one. So really, you're just setting two quantities, because it's only, you know, you have a normal derivative only for one or one combination of components of the constraint, and that's what allows you to extract from it. So.